January 1st, 1965, 27 years old, and went to work at Capitol Records.
Jesus loves to fill what is empty. In John chapter 2, we read about his first recorded miracle, turning water into wine. Jesus is at a wedding party, and in those days, a wedding party wasn't just an afternoon event. It was a seven-day extravaganza. And Jesus finds out that the host has run out of wine. That was a significant problem. It would have been embarrassing because they were supposed to save wine, and they've run out. So Jesus asks for six jars, empty jars, and he has them filled with water, and then he turns the water into wine, and John points out that it's not just wine, it's the best wine. And this tells us something about Jesus. He loves to fill what's empty, and when he fills something empty, he fills it with what's best. In John 4, Jesus finds a woman at the well, and she has an empty life, and he fills it. In John 6, he faces a vast crowd of people who are starving. They are so hungry, and he fills their stomachs with food, and there's food left over. In the home of Jairus, he finds emptiness that comes from the loss of his daughter, and he fills the house with joy once again when he brings the girl back to life. Of course, you'll also find people in the Gospels who were not filled by Jesus, mostly because they were trying to fill up themselves on their own, like the rich young ruler who had filled his life with money and possessions and position, but none of those things satisfied. And whether it's those things or whether it's a romantic relationship or endless entertainment or physical pleasure, this idea of us trying to fill our own emptiness, that's still pretty common.
The Beatles, you know, they had done everything they could do. They couldn't be more number one, so they fancied the idea of being businessmen. They wanted to pool all their resources into one place and take advantage of the income flows from all the different aspects of their career. They set up the record company, a film company, an invention company, which was Madhouse. That thing was crazy. Then the booking agency and the publishing. So they had like five divisions. And so I was the head of the record division in America. With the Beatles, it was total madness. No matter what we did, we actually had to get an armored car. And we had to back the armored car right up flush to the loading door for instruments so we could get them in without people getting to them, and then same way getting them out. And there was this crush of fans around us, and we barely got in the door, and Paul goes, I can't figure out what that's all about. You'd be in a car with them, or you'd be in their home, or you'd be in a studio or someplace. Everything was much different. It was very calm. They were very natural, very easy to be with. They would just be as interested in me and what I'm doing as I was with them. Just a great camaraderie that I had with them. George himself, he was such a gentle, kind person. We'd be in the kitchen at his house, and he'd be cooking up some veggies. He's a vegetarian. And I'd be standing in the kitchen talking, and he'd start talking to me about karma. He'd say animals, when they get killed, they are filled with fear. So when you eat flesh, you're eating fear. You know, he would just talk to me about his beliefs, and it really kind of registered with me, but I never thought about doing that myself. But it was George that planted the seeds, and he was an example to me of just how it had worked for him. I had the old Lash LaRue estate up in Laurel Canyon, which is a big main house and three guest houses. I had the servants, I had the gardener and the cook and the drivers. I had a home on 10 acres of summer home up in Northern California on the Mendocino Coast. Actors and actresses and rock stars and all this kind of stuff in the house at one time. I'd have Ringo Starr and Leonard Nimoy at the house the same night and things like that, you know. I had made a decision when I got in the music business that I saw all these crazy people. You know, they're all drugged out and they're all egoed out and everything is just kind of nuts. I thought, I'm never going to be like them. I'm going to be smart. I have a degree. I'm going to make it, you know, on my intelligence and stuff like that. And about 5 years later, all of a sudden I stopped and went, wait a minute, I'm just as nuts as they are. And I become one of them without realizing it. People always say Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles, you know, but they're giving her way too much credit. If you want to break up any band, give them a number one record, give them great success, because that's the first thing that just tears every band apart. Now they're starting to have wives, now they're starting to have their own kind of personal music directions, and then we set up Apple Records, and that thing turned out to be a nightmare. I mean, it was just a mess from the get-go. So when we did the concert on the roof, which I think is probably the most historical moment in rock and roll, you had a sense that everything was getting ready to unravel. Right after that's when the Beatles, you know, started breaking up. A big part of my life, after the Beatles was the outlaw movement when I was producing Waylon and Jesse and Tom Paul and Willie and all those people. And with the Outlaws, we brought this thing from the dirt up. Seeing Waylon come from playing in bars where they have to have a screen because the beer bottles won't hit them, you know, on the stage, to selling out major auditoriums. The Outlaws made the rock and rollers look like choir boys. I mean, if you want to talk about down and dirty and drugs and a hard, rough life, you know, man, that was it. I always used to call it a separate reality. You get on the tour bus and nothing's real anymore. And then you get home and you go back into family and nothing makes sense. So you're just in two completely different worlds all the time. I had the home up in the Laurel Canyon, and I remember getting up and just feeling totally empty. And I walked outside and I sat on the little bench out there, looked out across the canyon. I thought, wait, I've got a number one record on the charts. I've got all this, all my toys. And running around with the rich and famous. Everything's just on top of the world, yet I feel just empty. Something's wrong. I knew I needed something.
In Luke 14, Jesus tells a story known as the Great Banquet. In this story, a man sends out invitations for a feast. When the table is set, and the stove is hot, and the food is ready, he sends out a servant to announce to those who've been invited that dinner is served. But no one really wants to go. One of the guests that he invited explains that he has a field to inspect. A second guest says that he just bought some oxen and it's not a good time. A third guest apologizes and explains that he's just gotten married. They all seem to appreciate the invitation to come and to eat and to be filled, but it's just that their lives are pretty full. It's not a good time. The second guest in the story talks about his new oxen. And you might think of this as another purchase or possession, but really this is a reference to work, to business. He has responsibilities that need to be taken care of. He has to put some more time in at the office. And this is how many of us have tried to fill the emptiness in our lives, by climbing the ladder of success, by reaching certain professional goals. If it's not busyness from business, then we try to fill every second with some form of entertainment. The third guest to decline the banquet invitation might be the hardest to criticize. I mean, you really want to slap him on the back and say, congratulations, you just got married. But he's returned from his honeymoon and it's not a good time for them. The calendar is full. And I guess that describes us as well. Our minds are distracted, our lives are oversaturated, so much so that Jesus offers us an invitation to fill ourselves at his banquet, and we just don't have room for it. But the time will eventually come for each of those guests and for each of us when we realize that what we thought would fulfill us has left us feeling empty.
The first person I mentioned that to, that I'm successful, but I'm real unhappy. They said, well, you know, I meditate. And meditation just really calms me down. And a guru makes up the practices, the meditation practices. But you just do the practices. And they said, oh, hey, the guru is coming to America and we're going to have a week in the retreat in the mountains. And why don't you come on? So I came and I loved the guy. Then pretty soon, like a year and a half after I had started meditating, I'm now teaching meditation. I'm doing astral projection. I'm doing crystal healings. And I got so deep into it. And I thought, wow, you know, I'm making all these big bucks for these big companies. Why don't I set up my own corporation and make the big bucks for myself? Well, I did. That's when I really got into the drugs and everything else like that, and all the partying and all that. When you get in that atmosphere, it's all ego-driven, it's all just self-satisfaction type thing. You start giving up a little piece of yourself, and after a while you give away so many pieces that there's no pieces left of what you originally were when you got into it. And I quit taking care of business. So now I'm not getting the hit records anymore, I'm not getting the big projects. So pretty soon the company goes down, takes me down with it. My life totally fell apart. The toys went away, the summer homes went away, the estate went away, the servants went away, the Mercedes went away, everything went away. And then the failure came my way, and there I was, this confused person, not knowing what the heck had just happened to me. My pride was still so intact that I knew that I was gonna be back on top pretty soon. I said, no problem, man. I make hit records, I know what I'm doing. I got off the airplane with three cardboard boxes and three suitcases, and I'm basically standing on the curb in Nashville, Tennessee, a place where I'd had great success, and it was such a lonely, empty feeling. I didn't have anything. I was just, all of a sudden, here I am, almost 50 years old, alone in this town. I had a couple people to make phone calls to try and get things going again, but it wasn't happening. I couldn't get a job in companies I used to run. I mean, I couldn't get a job in the mailroom of the record companies in Nashville. Doors were shut. It just didn't make sense. And it just kept getting worse and worse. Trying to dig yourself out of a hole and have people say, hey, yeah, come on, we'll do this. And then calling up a few days later, oh, we're not gonna do this after all, you know. It got to the point to where I was homeless one day. I was desperate. I met a young lady that should have no business having anything to do with me because I was a stoner, I was broke, I had a bad reputation. She keeps talking about Jesus. And I said, well, yeah, Jesus is cool, man. He's one of the ascended masters. You know, he's one of the great, great teachers of all times. And he's one of the many paths to the top of the mountain. She said, no, he's the only path. He's the only way. And I said, no, no, I agree. He is a way. And she said, no, he's the way. I said, look, let's meet in the middle someplace. I was carrying my guru's picture in my pocket. It just drove her crazy. I had this picture of this guy in my billfold. I'll change gurus for you, and you get off this Jesus thing a little bit, and we can find a spot in the middle that works. She said, no, Jesus is the way. We kept arguing about this, but during the time, we're getting closer and closer together. She was trying to get to me through the music business. So she would take me to the Petra concerts and the Milo Lefevre concerts and all the different Rich Mullins and all the things that were very contemporary at that time in Nashville. And then she would pray over me and get me to go to church with her, but you know, it just wasn't happening. She called me and said, I need to talk to you tonight. I can see where our relationship is heading. And she said, yeah. I cannot become unequally yoked, and I have to make a decision. The decision is between you and Jesus. She said, I choose Jesus. I was stunned because I knew that she cared about me. When she did that, she walked out the walk, and I thought, I want to believe in something as much as she believed in, that I'm willing to give up something that I really care about, because I've never had that kind of thing. So at that point, I was about a 40% Christian, and then when she did that, I just crossed over from 50 to 51%. Then I was all in. That was the turning point for me. Now, the interesting thing is, I became a Christian, and everything didn't go, oh my gosh, now I'm waltzing off the sunset, you know, with the music and everything's wonderful. My life even got worse. To me, in my street way of thinking, it was almost saying, okay, if you're just coming to be a Christian just to have a good time and so I'll sort everything out, I want to know just how much you really do believe. I want to know how real this is to you. Let's just continue on this way for a little while and see if you still stick with me, you know. I finally did get a job as a stagehand, which is a 20-some-year-old person's job. Whitney Houston was headlining, and she didn't like the way her stage monitors were placed in front of her, so she stepped back. She's not gonna do one more song or one more anything until they're just the way she liked to have them in front of her. So she turns and signals for a stagehand to come out and arrange the monitors. Well, I used to be a big, you know, a big man in this town, and I'm not gonna go out there in front of 15 or 20,000 people and let them see what finally happened to me. And it's like God said, "Whip, hold on here, hoss. We're gonna take a real big chunk out of that pride thing tonight, so you get your happy buns out there because you're working for me now." In order for me to make the monitors just the way she wanted them, I had to get down on my knees. And the front row was filled with the record company presidents and executives and famous producers. I used to be one of these people. They'd been wondering what happened to Ken Mansfield, and now they knew. And they're looking at me, you know. And I've looked down at them, and my sweat's running down my face. And I looked up the nice guy, and I said, "Lord, Father God, this is the most humiliating moment in my very life. And but, Father, I understand what you want. I love you more than anything I've ever loved. And you know, you've pulled me out of the pits of hell, Father. I'll do anything you want." So I arranged those monitors like monitors have never been arranged in the history of rock and roll, because those monitors were arranged unto the Lord. I was diagnosed with an incurable cancer in 1996. And I was given 1 to 3 years to live, and there was no cure, and there was no treatments, there was nothing. It's just like, it's gonna get worse, you're gonna feel worse, and you're gonna die. Well, they had an experimental treatment, and I tried it, and look, you know, see what year this is now, so obviously it worked. So I thought, wow, I've gone through that battle with God on my side. It's my first battle now of going through something heavy with the Lord. Then a few years later, I get another cancer, and this one was brutal. I mean, it was just the heaviest chemo and radiation. But I vowed to God. I said, "Lord, I trust you. I know you're in this. So I don't care how bad this gets, I'm not gonna bail on you. I'm gonna stay strong in my walk with you." Then a few years later, I have a stroke. And here I am again. Going through a battle with the Lord by my side. And each time it's different. I understand more. You get stronger in these things. Before, when you didn't have the Lord, it just would have been impossible. I don't think I could have gone through three things without bailing out, without cashing in. It's kind of interesting that I was homeless one day, because that was the very bottom. I had no place to go, I had no money. And then what I thought was my bottom was because I was just having such a bad time, or I was being punished for being a bad person with all the reasons I thought. But just really God loving me so much that he knew it was time to start emptying all that stuff out so he could put something better in there. And then little by little, he started filling me back up with the testimony of the person who became my wife. By the people I met, he just started filling with the teachings, with the word. God is the greatest economist of all time. I spent 10 years in New Age, and people say, "Well, you sure wasted that 10 years, didn't you?" And no, I didn't waste it. God used that because I can talk to people who are into the New Age very easy. I know where their head's at. I know that you couldn't have convinced me not to be there when I was there. And the neat thing about it is, because I was with the Beatles, people say, "Oh, this guy's got cred, right? I got street cred because I was with the Beatles, and if I was with the Beatles, I must know what I'm doing." And so if I was with the Beatles and I say Jesus is cool, then he must be cool because this guy was with the Beatles, right?
When life leaves you empty, the truth is you've never been in a better position to be filled by God. You see, finally you have some space to make your way to his banquet table and to be filled with what he has for you. If life hasn't left you empty, then can I encourage you to empty yourself? It doesn't come naturally, but what if you just began to pray this prayer? God, empty me of me and fill me with you. It was the 19th century evangelist D.L. Moody who put it in these terms. He wrote, "I firmly believe that the moment our hearts are emptied of pride and selfishness, ambition and self-seeking, and everything that is contrary to God's law, that then the Holy Spirit will come and fill every corner of our hearts. But if we are full of pride and conceit and ambition and self-seeking and the pleasures of this world, then there's no room for the Spirit of God. And I believe that many people are praying for God to fill them when they're already full of something else. Before we pray that God will fill us, I believe we probably need to pray for Him to empty us. Said another way, there needs to be an emptying before there can be a filling.
The people now that see me now and knew me when, and they go, you're what now? I said, well, yeah, I'm a minister now. And we travel, we speak at churches and colleges and conventions or things like that, giving my testimony. I was speaking at a large church in Southern California, and after my testimony, the pastor would come up and join me for a Q&A period. And he called on a lady way in the back of the auditorium. I don't know how he even saw her. He said, when I was a very young girl, I used to go to this incredible church that had a most wonderful youth program for girls. And every year we would go away for one whole week as a retreat. And we sat down and he said, okay, here's what we're gonna do tonight. I'm gonna pass around a hat. In that hat are gonna be the names of some very decadent young people. You will take a name out and you will pray for that person's salvation until you either know in your heart or you have empirical knowledge that this person has come to the Lord. The names in the hat were the Beatles and the people that were with them. She said, me and my three girlfriends all picked the same name out of the hat, Ken Mansfield. Who's Ken Mansfield? She said, I was going for Paul McCartney. I wanted to pray for Paul McCartney, you know. Every morning when I opened my Bible, there was that name. I promised and I prayed for that person's salvation. She said, I got into the workplace and started getting successful. Didn't have quite as much time for church and for Bible reading. Eventually, I really started rocking and rolling. I was having a good time. And she said, finally, I just turned my back on the Lord. And she said, I was just really having a great time. About a year ago, everything came crashing down. It was awful. She said, about a month ago, all of a sudden, I had this feeling that God was like tugging at my heart, saying, hey, my child, remember how sweet it was when we used to go away on the retreats together and how it was when you were with me, when you walked with me, how special and how peaceful your life was? I woke up this morning and there was an ad in the newspaper that said a man named Ken Mansfield, who used to be with the Beatles, is here giving his testimony at this church tonight. She said, I looked at that ad and it was like it was just jumping at me like God was saying, hey, have I ever left you alone? I answer prayer, don't I? I've come here tonight, Pastor, to tell you that I'm back. Now, this is a large congregation. This pastor and I had seen everything in our lives, and we were both just standing there. We couldn't even talk, you know. It was very clear to me that God had always, you know, kind of had his hand on me, just saying, come on, well, let's go. Never give up. Never give up.